forgot who picked the title, The Future of SIV. So this is a little bit speculative and a little bit of the usual diagnostic data summaries that I do, because I think those are important to explain and not just put out there as reports for people to read on their own. More and more, and this was my advice to Lisa, don't do this stuff by yourself. Don't do any of this. Really try to work in a team, and I can't thank enough Monsie Tormorell, new mommy that she is, still fantastically active in all my research now. I am just a co-PI or co-investigator with Monsie, and she's the lead. And Amy Vincent, of course, at the USDA, a fabulous influenza researcher. Her team now has broken up. Pravina Kittikun is now with Merck, and Tavis Anderson is now at some small college in Georgia, in Savannah. So USDA needs some more permanent researchers, because all those guys are postdocs, and of course they just leave after they accomplish so many things. John Corsland, Grandpa Flu, I think we're going to call him now. He's getting better at that. Richard Webby, the godfather of flu, and Susan Detmer at the University of Saskatchewan, the Canadian flu goddess. Hopefully she rises to that title. So. And this is anybody who's seen these before, just go next, because you gotta always start this off. So the ducks are in the wild waterfowl are the natives host for influenza viruses, and then they spill out their influenza viruses, all 16 H's, all 9 N's, so all 164 combinations of that, to the environment. And that's how we, as other species, and our other species that we work with, like poultry and pigs and horses and dogs and cats, pick up those viruses from those wild waterfowl. And so that's the, go back one. So that's the avian-centric view, is this circle here. And a lot of public health and focus that we end up with is the pig-centric view. It's the pig is spewing out all these viruses. To turkeys and to humans and to ferrets, not as wild ferrets, but as a model. But there's some host range restriction here. And it is thought, and it is pretty likely that a virus does have to pass through a mammalian host before it's adapted to humans. And that's why swine and are implicated in these things. And then these have references here for these great pictures. Next slide. So it all starts with the wild waterfowl, and then it goes global. And when we're talking about global influenza viruses, we can't say that we all have the same viruses. This is just a lot of different pretty colors, but we have all the different influenza viruses. The more pigs you have in a population, the more influenza viruses you have in a population, or the influenza diversity is greater. And so that's why in Australia they seem to only have one, some type of influenza circulating, but in China, in Southeast Asia, in Europe, in the US, a lot of influenza virus evolution and diversity there. This was recently published, an excellent review of every country. So if somebody is looking for global, or somebody's consulting globally, or trying to make a global vaccine, certainly refer to that ZPH paper that just came out with a whole slew of authors on it. Next. A little more simply, how did we get to this diversity? Back in 1918, the first influenza viruses were discovered, and that was the 1918 pandemic associated with World War I and H1N1 influenza viruses. Pigs and humans infected at the same time, likely an avian influenza virus based on some back sequencing that was done on some archived specimens. And things continued along like that. This is for swine. Things continued along to 1998 until we had a human influenza virus introduced in our pigs in 1998. And then after that, those viruses reassorted. So when two viruses get in the same host cell, two influenza viruses get in the same host cell, they exchange gene segments through a process called reassortment. And so since 1999, all the way to 2009 and 2010 and beyond, we've had every type of reassortment you can think of, some more fit than others. Certainly H3N2 is a more fit virus than H3N1, and H1N2 seems to be more fit lately than H1N1. in all sorts of different variations. And so the future of SIV, human viruses will get into our pigs, avian viruses will get into our pigs, and we'll reassort some more and make new subtypes. Again, next slide. So there's just been a lot of work and multi-center collaborations looking at all this data. So we were sequencing influenza viruses at the University of Minnesota since 2002, and just getting all that data. Well, once you have a lot of data, then you can start to try to figure out where do they come from and how did this virus evolve, and which viruses are going to seem to dominate in the next season. That's the prediction part is a little bit hard. But certainly what's happening is our pigs have acquired influenza viruses from birds and humans and have reassorted them, and they are continuing to exchange gene segments. And this publication in Journal of Virology from August 2012 shows that our viruses that were already in our swine then reassorted with the viruses from the human pandemic of 2009, the pandemic H1N1. And so now our viruses of swine have what we call the pandemic, or the PM, the pandemic matrix gene in them. And when our viruses acquire the pandemic matrix gene, that imparts the ability of the virus to transmit more, or to transmit more efficiently. And that's been shown when they reassort the virus, so they can get it to go from ferret cage to ferret cage by aerosol and not just by contact. And that seems to be true in our viruses that we're finding in humans at the fairs. So let's go to the next place. When we looked at, there's a lot of interest in H3N2 last year, and there's already interest in it again this year. Is that when they looked at these H3N2 viruses that were getting into humans at swine expos and fairs, which thankfully the CDC and the WHO called H3N2V and not swine H3 or swine flu. They called it H3N2V, so that's a little bit confusing, but what the V means for humans is it's a variant. It's not their seasonal H3. So H3N2V. And they saw that, in Pravina's work, they saw that all those viruses that were getting to humans at fairs, regardless of it was Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio, or Minnesota, or Iowa, they were kind of grouping together in this subcluster A of H3s. And we had all these other subclusters in our pigs, B, C, D, E, F. So our H3N2s are even more diverse than we previously thought, but the ones that were getting into humans seem to be clustering into subcluster A there. Next slide. The N2s were a little bit less diverse. We have kind of just two big groups of N2s in our viruses, and these are from H1N2s and H3N2s. But the ones that were in humans were predominantly in this cluster down here from 2002, and the ones in our pigs could be any cluster. So that was kind of interesting as well. Next slide. These are just pretty trees. But then what's been really interesting is to see this, how many of our viruses now have, in swine, have acquired that pandemic matrix gene. And it's about 50% of them. So any type of virus we look at now, there's a 50% chance that it's reassorted with the pandemic virus and has that pandemic, at least the pandemic matrix gene on the inside. There's 8 genes in influenza virus, and we routinely sequence 3 as part of surveillance, and one of them is that matrix gene. Next slide. What does this mean for the pig? Okay, we're all, yes, we don't want humans to get sick and die. Everybody agrees with that. What does this mean for our pigs? Well, the H3N2 virus with the pandemic matrix gene, or the H3N2 virus that got into a human, or a regular swine H3N2 viruses, you put that into the pig, and the pig responds the same way. Pneumonia's about the same, the recovery time's about the same, the transmission's about the same, on an experimental level. On the herd level, it seems to be that the virus transmits herd to herd a little bit better. Let's go to the next slide. And all influenza viruses are not the same, and so it's been a challenge because you want to speak to the producers and to other veterinarians and things like that. Well, let's control the H3N2 that you have. In reality, you kind of have to figure out, well, maybe what kind of H3N2 do they have? Because it could have any one of these gene constellations. And is that really important or not? Luckily, the H and the N really drive that immune response. So if you have a common H and N, you can probably attack the virus of that way with a vaccine. But just know there's a lot of different gene constellations out there. And this is important when we are trying to follow outbreaks. So if humans all get sick and they say, well, it's H3N2 and it must have come from pigs, well, actually you can look at all eight genes and say, well, actually the virus from the human has three different genes than our viruses in our pigs, so it's not exactly the virus that we need. So you really have to look at all eight genes to get those genetic links like that. Next slide. Just a derivation of the chain. So if we start talking in the future of SIV, we're not just going to talk about H3N2, but we're going to talk about the H3N2 genotype. Is it genotype 1, 2, 3, 4? And as more researchers discover that perhaps PB2 of genotype 7 is important for piglet mortality or something like that, that's why it's important to get this information out there. So the future of SIV was to take this genotype data and apply it to phenotype data or to vaccination strategies. Right now, we're trying to define the viruses themselves. Next slide. And so who cares about all this stuff? Well, the fact is that these triple reassortant viruses that we have in our pigs, and then they reassort again with pandemic viruses, they can infect humans. And there is... since about 2001 or 2005, they started reporting a lot more closely when a human gets an influenza virus that's not seasonal influenza virus, where did it come from? And in the United States, it seemed to be coming from pigs. And so this summary from the New England Journal of Medicine was just 11 patients that had H1 viruses. Between 2005 and 2009, and did they have contact with pigs or not? Well, yes, they did. Close, but I love humans. They get pretty good. When you ask them to help, they can really do things pretty well. Close proximity to a pig refers to standing within 6 feet of a pig. So, I am not within close proximity to Lisa, but Melissa is. I just love Epi. Human epi people, they can really narrow that down. Next slide. And I think it's really important to, as we enter into fair season, and then we're going to enter into flu season in our farms, and in the southern part of the United States, it's kind of a nice flu season right now, is what we've kind of figured out, is that these H3N2Vs that they say in humans are the reassortant H3N2 pandemic matrix genes we find in our pigs. And they came about from reassorting with our regular swine H3N2s in the pandemic. Next slide. So since 2012, there's been greater than 300 cases. And the Pork Board and the USDA and the fair veterinarians have done a great job of putting out brochures on recommendations to the officials at the fairs and the exhibitors and the pigs, and what to do with those pigs, how to screen the stock before entry, animal movements and practices, and recommendations on vaccines for kids and pigs. Next slide. I think I have one. And this just came out on Thursday. A little bit about Midwestern swine. That seems to where all the exposures are occurring, or it's in the Midwest, which is kind of interesting. But specifically in Minnesota, there was 9 confirmed cases of variant influenza viruses in humans. 5 of those were H3N2B. 4 were H1N2B. We have to be a little bit different in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We had 6 cases at our Minnesota State Fair. 3 of those were people who had live animal. 6 cases with the Minnesota State Fair. 3 cases of people that went to live animal markets, and this is just another plug for Monsie. So she got involved in this live animal market. It's actually in my hometown of South St. Paul, but she worked very closely with the Minnesota Department of Health, the CDC, to study the live animal market and how are these people getting infected with influenza at the live animal markets. Well, what you do at the live animal market in South St. Paul is you go up and you look at your pigs and you stand there and you say, I want that one. And sometimes the pig will come up to you. You could touch it, you know, but usually the pigs are just running around. You say, I want that one. And then you go over here and you stand behind glass and you can watch them butcher it. And then they give you the fresh cuts in a basket. And you take the basket home. And then you do whatever you want with it. And so I've actually received the heads of these pigs from people's freezers. Once their five-year-old gets sick and goes to the hospital, then the Minnesota Department of Health will call them and say, well, do you have any of that pig left in your house? And they're like, oh, yeah, we saw the head. We were going to make head cheese, and we didn't get to do it yet. So I've gotten actually frozen heads that I've extracted the nasal turbinates and swabbed them and recovered influenza virus from the frozen head 2 weeks after that they harvested. But what she found at the live animal market, so not only am I able to find it in the respiratory tract of the pig, they're not eating the lungs, but there's some head cheese there, is that live animal market, all the railings are contaminated with influenza virus. The air has influenza virus in it, but the people aren't picking it up from the air. They're picking it up from the railings because they'll go, drink, touch the railing, drink your coffee, rub your nose, all that pig was kinky, and inoculate themselves. Or if you like my daughter, she's a nail chewer. So she would probably look at the pigs and then chew her nails and think about it. What am I going to do? So that's been really interesting. And actually, Monsie won an award from the CDC for the best research or whatever. Because they, and so what they're trying to do at the live animal markets is clean up the contact areas that the humans have. And so this came out in Minnesota just on Thursday, just to say, hey, everybody, remember last year this happened in Minnesota? And we've already had several H3N2B at Indiana this year already. They're the first fair. So, I wonder if Minnesota's fair was in June, if we would have, I think it's just they are the first fair and they look for it. And it's so now physicians are supposed to be screening humans for flu if they have respiratory disease and exposure to swine, because this isn't a flu season for humans. June, July, August, the kids are out of school. And so there isn't a lot of flu right now, but there can be. And so they're asking people, and it's amazing, you have to remind the physicians every year of these things. Well, I guess I'm a pig vet, so it's always on my mind. Next slide. So that's the future of SIV, is that we're probably going to have more cases of flu at the fair this year. Thanks to the USDA surveillance system, we have a lot of H3N2 viruses to study. And when Pravina did this, work figuring out these 10 genotypes and what they're made of and what they do in pigs and how they react, there was over 100. Now there's probably over 600 H3N2s in the system. Next slide. And then we'll just get into some of the subtype data, and then I'll go back to the future again. So this is what swine veterinarians like to see. What subtypes are out there? This is what vaccine companies like to see. H1N1, H1N2, H3N2, what's out there? And knowing that, then you have to go a little bit deeper. So at the gross level, back in 2008, we found primarily H1N1s, just a very few H1N2s, and very few H3N2s. So just a lot of H1N1. And then we had the pandemic, and there was a decrease in testing. And then we got over that. And plus, we weren't seeing a lot of flu this summer, but then we got over it. And the H1N1s were still dominant. And then when we really got everybody back on board with testing again, and we were getting the whole United States sample, we were finding, just like we used to see in 2004, 2005, about a third of our viruses are H1N1, a third are H1N2, and a third are H3N2. And then people started to say, I think I'm having more H3N2 problems. And sure enough, the surveillance would say that as well. And over 40% of the isolates were H3N2 in about the fourth quarter of 2011. And then it settled down again with a third, and a third. Note that we have detected H3N1 again. We first detected it in 2006, and now it's back in 2012. And we have a lot of mixed infections that we're detecting or reporting. Some of these are true mixed infections, where we were all one nasal swab from a single pig that has two viruses in it. A lot of these are oral fluids or pooled samples. So oral fluid is already pooled. But I have worked with farms that have two different influenza viruses in the same farrowing room, different pigs, H3N2 and H1N1. And it just happened again last week, farrowing pigs with two influenza viruses. Not the same pig, but a pig in the same pen had a different influenza virus. So mixed infections are real and they occur. Next slide. Just a little bit of close-up of 2002, if some of you, 2012, people like to see that. Just that even distribution, and then H1N1's still dominating. Same slide. Now this gets into the genetic data, the genetic cluster that these viruses fall into. So the alpha, beta, gamma, delta pandemic are all H1 viruses, and we're working on some nomenclature things. Because when we talk about alpha viruses in the United States, in Canada, that makes sense to us. But in Europe, they call them the swine-like H1N1 viruses, classical swine H1N1 viruses. We also have beta, gamma viruses of swine, and those are all progeny of the original swine classical H1N1 virus from 1918. They're just different reassortments of those. The Delta viruses are different, and they have their origins in human influenza viruses, from seasonal human influenza viruses of the early 2000s, and they spilled into our pigs, and we detected them at first in about 2005. And they've really become well established in our pigs. And then, of course, we have the pandemic H1N1 virus still circulating in pigs today. H3N2, we lump them all into cluster 4 because right now we're in a period of expanding genetic diversity of H3s. So they're very genetically diverse. There's many different genotypes. And so we're lumping them into a big cluster of cluster 4 H3s. But no, in reality, there's probably at least 6 or 7 subclusters of H3s. And which ones are going to dominate? And so it's really tough to choose a single H3 vaccine for an entire country. And we have had human seasonal influenza viruses in our pigs this year. In remote locations, remote farms, small research farms where we don't give up until we figure out what the heck kind of flu was that. And what it was, it's a human seasonal H3 flu, very closely matching the A. Victoria, the dominant human seasonal H3 strain that's in the humans throughout the world. And pigs get flu from humans all the time. And Delta, pandemic, cluster 4, and human seasonal H3 all came from humans into our pigs. Next slide. This is just showing that genetic diversity of North American influenza. Here's the human seasonal H3s down here. And this is a tree, and it's at the very high up level, so you can't really see much detail. Notice this is on a completely different branch. Here's our current commercial vaccines. The two of the commercial vaccines, Merck and Zoetis, have cluster 4 H3s in them. And yes, they're at the base of the tree and there's some cross-reaction, but certainly they're not on the same branch as what's circulating in the USA or as what's circulating in Canada. And then the Mexican viruses, they're a subcluster unto themselves. Certainly there's some Canadian viruses that will cluster here with these USA viruses and vice versa, and Mexican viruses that will cluster in the USA and vice versa. But geographically and temporally as well, these viruses cluster out over time. So there's a real need. I think everybody in this room, even those that don't work for vaccine companies, would say, hey, maybe we should update this vaccine. Doesn't seem to be clustering with what we have. Yes?
Do you think that the vaccine caused the clusters to, the predominant clusters to move? Because if all the pigs were vaccinated, then...
There's Yeah, natural immunity will drive influenza virus change as well as vaccinal immunity. And so that's what I'd like to see all this genetic data go to the next step, is to say, and that's actually Monsi's doing some research with that, when we apply vaccine, do we force the virus to change faster or not? In pigs, we thought that we weren't driving the virus to change very much because our pigs live for a short time, and we're always introducing susceptible pigs in the form of weaned pigs as soon as their antibodies wane, right? So we thought we weren't driving change. So one of the things that's driving change, I think, more is the reassortment with the avian viruses. I talked to a chicken influenza person once, and they said, if you want an influenza virus to change, put it in a chicken, and it really changes. So the acquisition of avian influenza genes and the vaccines, and those are two things that drive change. And it's a very successful virus. It will change its virus property itself. So two things drive that change. But yeah, we need to get at those specific questions, and we can study that on a population level, and that's what Monsi's currently doing. Next slide. Okay, so now I have a link. How do we get at all this cluster data, and how would you kind of make the diagnosis? And JQ at Iowa State University, he gets his own slide for himself. He put together this data combining University of Minnesota and Iowa State influenza testing data that we contribute to the USDA. Next slide. And what he wanted to do was correlate when we screen for flu by PCR, or we subtype it, we sequence, and we virus isolation, how do we get at this data? What samples may be the best for submission? Next slide. These are really fast ones. The types of samples we're testing, if we look, I think this is the combined data here, but we used to do predominantly lungs and nasal swabs. And then since 2010, we've tested a lot of oral fluids for influenza virus. And then since 2012, that's the dominant sample that we test for influenza, oral fluids. It's so easy to collect, and research shows that it's more sensitive at picking up influenza in a population because you're able to screen essentially every animal in the barn. So it's a good test. And Matt Allerson's work had shown that he was able to detect influenza in nasal swabs in a population for a certain amount of time, but he was able to detect influenza in oral fluids in that population for months longer than individual nasal swabs. Next slide. What I really wanted to show you was this. This is a combination of our data, and this might help you guide some future, see, I get the title in here, future diagnostic decisions based on your data. Really, obviously, the stronger the PCR result, so the lower the CT value, how quickly it came up positive on the test, the more likely it is that you'll be able to get a subtype. And so we were able to find that if we're able to detect flu and the CT value is under 30, we'll get you a subtype almost every time, 98% of the time. And that's regardless of the sample type, lung, nasal swab, and oral fluid. If we have a strong CT value, less than 30, about 95% of the time or more, we'll get you a subtype, and not just, yes, you have flu, but what subtype of flu. Next sample. Next slide, that's good. And then are we able to get you a sequence on that sample? And this gets a little bit trickier. So just because we detected it by PCR, were we able to get you a sequence? Oral fluids, even really strong positives, less than 25, only able to get a sequence about 55% of the time. Same with nasal swabs, but lungs are a little bit better, 68% of the time. If we're able to get a virus isolate, then those numbers increase to 70, 80, and 90% for lungs. So if there's a virus isolate, if we get a virus isolate, and we usually get virus isolates on things less than 25 or less than 30, we'll get you a sequence as well. Next slide. This is a great slide too. We don't always get influenza viruses isolated out of our samples. If there's a lung sample and it's less than 25, on the PCR, the CT value is less than 25, almost 80% of the time we'll get a virus isolate. So that's awesome. Nasal swabs, a little bit cleaner sample 85% of the time. Oral fluids, though, 41% of the time. So I love oral fluids. I think you can get virus out of them. You can sequence it. I think you can isolate it. But if you're having trouble, you can say, we oral fluid tested this farm for influenza. Yes, it's there. If I want a virus isolate, go necropsy some pigs. Go do some nasal swabs. All right? Because it's in an endemic situation, it'll still be there. Outbreak situation, you might miss it. The VI success rate for oral fluids is less than nasal swabs and lungs. So if you really want to get at what is the genotype of this H3N2, because I want to make a vaccine out of it, you're going to have to do the harder work with nasal swabs and lung tissues. Next slide. Next slide. This is our combined data. So that was Iowa. Maybe we were way, 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 way better than Iowa State. I don't know. But, combined data. Next slide. We just present it lots of different ways. Okay, next slide. It should go back. And then next slide. All right, so U of M research vision. So like I said, the majority of the influenza research at University of Minnesota is led by Montserrat Tormorell. And we're all lucky to collaborate with her. And so she's got these research visions, and she wants to take it to the pig population level. And we've done it. We've done it in our 20 pig rooms, you know, three rooms and 20 pigs. We do replicas. We run them through three times, so now we have more power to our studies. We still have to take that to the population. What's the role of replacement animals and people introducing new viruses? And I used to think that we had to throw people in our studies so we'd get the money from NIH and Health and Human Services and CDC. But really, every year, we're discovering a human seasonal influenza virus in our pigs in farms that are supposed to be the best, cleanest, never ever see anything. So it is good for us to figure out, as pig vets, what are the role of people in introducing new viruses to our pigs and replacement animals. Cesar Corso, who's with Genis now, was a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. He did a survey of 31 farms throughout the Midwest with Jim Lowe, and they did PADRAP risk assessment on those farms. And they saw that if you raised your own gilts on site, your farm was more likely to be flu positive, which is kind of contradictory to everything that we've seen. And so Monty's looked at that. How do we move gilts? Do we bring them in from the outside and raise them on site? Is it our virus or whose virus? So Monty's studying that. She's got 10 farms, and she's focusing on the gilts. Here's your gilts. Here's they came in. Here's their flu status. Here's the flu status of the pigs born of those gilts. And that's ongoing work by Andres Diaz. And it's in the abstract right now. Characterization of the young pig population under field conditions. So we've discovered, and it's been kind of well known, but you go back to the earlier work in the 70s, is these little pigs and little humans, kindergartners and things like that, they carry influenza for a longer time. And the maternal antibody protection is imperfect. And so they look kind of healthy, and they're just running around spreading viruses because they have the protection from disease from the maternal antibodies, but not from virus shedding. This gets to the question that Melissa asked, what's the genomic stability of influenza virus? Are we driving it to change? So experimentally and under field conditions, how much does that change? And how much does it change in populations? And to further characterize these indirect transmission routes, aerosol and fomites. An aerosol paper just came out this week in PLOS One by Cesar Corso, where he was a half mile, 1 mile, 2 miles from farms. And could he detect influenza virus in the air? And was it viable or not? And we could detect it out to 1.5 miles pretty consistently. Next slide. So there is aerosol transmission. Characterizing it, you know, what are the gilts doing? What are your baby pigs doing? And then once you know that, then you can work on control and mitigation of IV, of flu in that system, in the farm, between farm, from pigs to people, and pig to pig. From people to pigs. And then how do we vaccinate these populations? Do we focus just on the gilts? Do we focus on the sows? Do we do mass vaccination, which is my current recommendation, and maybe that'll be showing to be different here? How do we minimize endemicity? So Lisa, and we talked about this with PED, we really don't want it to be endemic. We don't want porcine endemic diarrhea. We really don't want endemic flu, but that's what we refer to it as. Biosecurity mechanisms to keep it out, filtration, air disinfection systems, and PPE. If just wearing masks and things, well, that reduces things. And because we want to look at the United States swine herd in general, the North American swine herd, the global swine herd, we're going to have to do some modeling. Because we can't get everybody to do all these interventions at the same time. So we're going to employ these epidemiological models to see if there's a better way to do things. And then the focus on regional control strategies for influenza. Next slide. So we're going to look at populations and which ones are important. And how can we evaluate? So then we're going to get to, yeah, let's vaccinate. Well, how do we evaluate strains and vaccines? Well, what thing you do is you gather strains through surveillance. And the nice thing now is there's thousands of strains at the USDA and SHP SIV repository, influenza repository, that anybody can get, anybody with a license to receive infectious materials. So all the vaccine companies have access to all these thousands of isolates for free. And we characterize them genetically and antigenically, and the best thing to do is to put them both together for people. Next slide. And one way to put them both together is through antigenic cartography. And I don't do a really good job of explaining antigenic cartography, but what it is a bioinformatics tool, and it provides a basis for a quantitative framework of assessment of that virus and how different it is from another virus. So a lot of things we would love to do is put a virus in a pig, or vaccinate a pig with one strain, 2 weeks later vaccinate again, 2 weeks later challenge it, and see how it did. Well, that's pretty slow. We need a way to do it in the lab, and this antigenic cartography does that. It says, genetically, these viruses look like this. Antigenically, in a cross-HI test, they interact with each other this way, and a serum from an animal infected with this strain reacts with this virus B. And does not react with virus C. And you plot those things together on a landscape to see how related the viruses are. Why should we use it? Is because there isn't a single inactivated swine influenza vaccine in the world that's sufficient to protect against circulating endemic swine influenza viruses in any geographic region. All of our inactivated vaccines are insufficient. They're okay. They reduce death loss. That's a good thing. But they're not going to control influenza. And then we're going to continue to have dissemination of influenza among different swine populations throughout the world. And if flu's not controlled in animals, and sometimes, like I said, this is a little bit self-serving, give us money, human people, because you guys have all the money. But it's true. If we don't control it, we're going to continue to have virus spilling from humans to pigs and pigs to humans. And just that shared interaction going on. Next slide. Pop over to this presentation, click on the link. So this is Nicola Lewis from the University of Cambridge in the Department of Zoology. She has this really fancy title for her laboratory. It's really cool. But she's able to do this antigenic cartography and say, what does the evolution of swine viruses look like? I presented this enrollment in April. Next slide. From 1930 to 2012, they have viruses. So you can get some really good evolution there. And her goal is to provide up-to-date global characterization of the antigenic diversity out there, just to say, sorry, vaccine companies, we're not buying your vaccines right now because they don't work. And so we're not buying the vaccine, so nobody's going to make one, because why would I make the vaccine that's nobody buying anyway? How can we get to the next level? Next slide. And what she's found is this is the genetic diversity. Here's that tree. And then when she combines the antigenic data, how they react with each other, she gets this kind of a landscape map. So, for example, let's say that these are all the pink viruses here. And yes, antigenically, they group together here. But then you get these oddball viruses that these gray ones should be grouping together, but they're not at all. Next slide. Might be better explained there. And so she looks at that, and she sees, does the genetic data map up with the antigenic data? So here we had a pink group in a green group that have a lot of cross-reaction with each other. And so would you pick a virus, vaccine virus, that's maybe right here, and you cover the pink and the green group there. Next slide. what she has found, which I'm trying to employ into routine use at the lab, and I'm not there, is in humans, and in equine, and in swine. She's looked at H3s in particular, and when there's changes at these key amino acids, 189, 145, 159, these are amino acids, if there's changes, that drives a change in the antigenic profile. So here's two viruses. Here's a green virus here. Genetically, the green viruses are supposed to be similar, grouped together. But because this virus has these changes, an N to a K at site 145, an N to a K at 156, a K to an E, and don't make me do the amino acid codes, aspire gene to something, it's completely antigenically different. And she's shown this time and time again with humans. This is the Wuhan and Sydney strains up there, Wu 95 and Psi 97, and with equines and swines. So what I've tried to do, next slide, and she's going to publish this. This is just all the data, putting everything together. So there's these key amino acids, 159, 155, 158. If there's changes in those key amino acids, then a virus will actually be antigenically different than its genetic group. So next slide. And next slide. Next slide. She does a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So let's go through that, blah, blah, blah. You have to hear her say it. She's got a beautiful English accent. So next slide. Now it should pop back to mine. All right. So what have I done? Well, I had a system. And I love working with the Canadians because they're very nice, but also because their systems are isolated. So when they say, this is our system, I really know that it's not, oh wait, did you import a bunch of pigs because you had an empty finisher? No, it's our system. And so let's look at his tree. Here's his H3s from 2011 to 2013. And I would say he'd have a yellow group, a pink group, and a kind of a teal group, and then a green one all by itself. And then the commercial vaccine. And he's like, well, what's the commercial vaccine? What, isn't that going to be good enough? It's got 94, almost 95% similarity, 94.7% similarity between the commercial vaccine and my teal group. So shouldn't that work? Look how close they are in the tree. Look how close they are genetically. Well, if we look at the teal group, which is here, D12-4, and we compare it to the commercial vaccine on top, we see that in bold at those key amino acid sites that the University of Cambridge and Nicola Lewis has identified. It's got changes from the vaccine at 5 of the 6 sites, N to K, H to Y, N to H, D to A to N. Only one amino acid site is the same. So no, I don't think the commercial vaccine is going to work against that teal group. It's not going to work against the pink group. It's not going to work against the yellow group because he's got 4 to 6 amino acid changes at key amino acid sites. So at the very minimum, we should be looking at these key amino acid sites. And I haven't found a way to automate this. I just have to ask one of those smart bioinformatics people to do this, and they can write it in a program like that. Right now I do this by hand just because I have to read out the Excel spreadsheet to do it for me. So we can apply this to the field, to your viruses. What is your virus look like at these sites compared to the vaccine you're using? And it might be our autogenous strain too. Next slide. I think we're out of time. But I was going to just, if you want to know about H7N9, it's a virus of birds. It's clinically inapparent in birds. 100 people or so got sick and died in China from exposure to birds at live bird markets or products of the live birds. They were defeathering the birds in a defeathering machine. And then the feathers went everywhere. Oh, there's like one slide with a bunch of pluses and minuses. I just want to show this one. In chickens, H7N9. Very easy to infect and transmit H7N9 and other low-path AI viruses. So chickens are great for shedding viruses. Turkeys, H7N9 wasn't able to infect them. They weren't able to see any transmission. And ducks, highly variable. And so the one thing about avian influenza viruses, you can't say it's all birds. There's 3,000 bird species out there. They react differently to different viruses. Next slide. So the susceptibility of the birds that would be in a live animal market in China. Chickens were more susceptible, H7N9, than Muscovy ducks, than pigeon ducks, than geese, than pigeons. Yes, H7N9 infects pigs, but doesn't appear to transmit. That's pretty common with a lot of the bird viruses in pigs. And this is what scared people, is that yes, it was able to infect ferrets, which is a human model, and transmit in ferret to ferret nose-to-nose contact, but the aerosol route was inconclusive in these beginning studies. So hats off to the Chinese for detecting H7N9 and describing it so thoroughly, and bringing experts into the live animal markets to see which animals had them, because the animals are inapparently infected. Next slide. They're the reservoir for infection, live bird markets, blah, blah, blah. Next. Be vigilant. Yes, next. This is just my take-home message. Right now in the in North America, we have many different genome constellations of flu and many different clusters of H1s and H3s. We're in a situation of expanding genetic diversity right now in our H3s. H1s, not so much. One specific genotype, H3N2, with pandemic matrix genes, which when it gets into humans, we call H3N2B, seems more likely to spill over into the human population in 2011, 2012, and now 2013. But also know that H1N2Bs can do that as well, which is what we found in Minnesota State Fair. The clinical disease caused by these reassorted viruses are similar or milder compared to contemporary swine IAV, which may be why they transmit better. Because pigs are able to move around more. They're not just laying around by themselves, keeping their food themselves. They're running around with different pens for different pigs. We're in a period of frequent reassortment, so we need to continue to monitor. And new influenza viruses will come from interspecies transmission, just like the 2009 pandemic, or these H3N2Bs, or the H7N9 currently in China. And that is mine.